You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Thursday, January 25th, 2024, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Kara Santa Maria.
Howdy.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
And Evan Bernstein.
Good evening, everyone.
How is everyone?
Doing good.
Doing all right. Getting a little jet-lagged, but I'm here.
Didn't land on your head like that Japanese probe back here?
No. No, I had a safe landing back in LA.
Thank goodness.
So what happened with that thing?
Yeah.
You know, it landed on its head.
And pictures don't lie.
Yeah, it was really interesting that they got a picture of it. You know, Evan and I were just trying to figure out how that happened, but the probe itself apparently released, you know, the cameras to take pictures of the landing. So you have
as part of the greater mission, there were some other probes released, which I didn't know about. I hadn't read about those prior to this incident today, in which this picture, which I think is now going to become a famous picture, I think, in space history.
Iconic.
Yeah, in a way, you know, not in a good way. Does that make it infamous? But yeah, there were these autonomous probes released by the package that was sent down, and they were down there to kind of capture, you know, the moment that the lander was supposed to land. So that's kind of interesting. You know, it's like sending the press down to, in a way, to, okay, here it comes, like, let's go see it, which is a great idea.
It is a great idea, and in fact, it should be incorporated even more, I think, into missions. I mean, it's like, we talked about previously the fact, like, the first Apollo mission that landed on the moon, Apollo 11, taking picture of it or videotaping everything was an afterthought, you know, and they didn't do a good job of it. It wasn't like really built into the mission. Like, we're going to do everything we can to get the best quality, you know, pictures and video of this historic event. Like, they just weren't thinking about it.
Not prioritized.
They even wiped out some of the film to reuse it. Like, what?
Yeah, they copied. Oh, they erased the tapes. Oh my gosh.
Later missions, that they got a clue and they started figure it out. But this is a good idea. Just drop a camera, film the landing, and in this case with the Japanese spaceship, like, it gives them really useful mission critical information that it's upside down, you know,
which is why they were having some issues.
Yeah. Oh, I wonder what's going on here. Oh, here's landing. Your problem.
Oh boy. I mean, that evil. It survived and touched down in this way also is kind of remarkable.
Yeah. Bob. It almost looks like a cartoon, you know, the way it's like on its head like that.
But it's quite the photo.
But again, it reminds us, like, it's, again, we grew up in the Apollo era, and it's like 50 years later. So to some extent, it seems like just landing on the moon isn't that big a deal. But it's hard. This is two missions now that have failed.
Did it completely fail? I mean,
well, I don't know that you would call it a success, landing on its head.
Well, it depends.
I mean, but it's on the moon.
If they can get the solar, you know, the photovoltaics working, I think they can get something accomplished. But I think that seems like it's up in the air at this point.
The mission is compromised.
There's apparently no way to write the fact that this machine is now standing on its wrong side. It has no compensation. There's no way to move it.
It has no way to turtle, like to flip over.
Right. It can't extend an arm and kind of push itself or anything else, apparently, from what I read.
I mean, it's still a pretty big deal. Only five, I just looked it up, there have only been five nations that have sent. Amazing. Can you name them all?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, wow. Well, they couldn't get the solar cells to work, it says here. They decided to hibernate it for now. Mm. Yeah, it doesn't look good.
Ah. Yeah. Well, I don't know. Do they think that they'll be able to send something in the future to fix it?
If you're going to send something and just make that thing the probe, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Probably be just as expensive.
But Kara, you're saying the five countries. Let me guess. Mm-hmm. United States, mm-hmm. Soviet Union, or Russia, China, India, and now Japan.
Yay! Good job.
Yay.
Too bad we just can't send Superman. Hey, Superman, go up there and just flip that thing over, please. Thank you.
Right.
Yeah.
That's cheating.
We'll send General Zod instead.
Yeah. No, he destroys stuff on the moon. He doesn't fix it.
So if there were superheroes of any kind like that, like people who could just fly to the moon, would that be a plus or a negative for our space program? Right? Would that like make us like lazy and overly reliant on them,
or
would it, Yeah, or would it help because like we have?
I doubt they would want to be monopolized in that way. But I think in certain scenarios, you know, you just have to build something that could sit there. You wouldn't need to really work consider anything else. Like here, drop this right here on Pluto. That would be great. That'd be awesome. But then, of course, crime would spike while he's away or she's away.
But is it instant? How quickly does he or she get there?
Well, I mean, assuming the laws, the speed of light is still relevant, it'd take a while.
Oh, yeah.
Did Superman ever go to the moon?
Oh, yeah.
Yes.
How long did it take him?
Did Superman go to the moon, or did just the bad guys go to the moon?
Well, in the movies, they fought, didn't they?
How long did it take him?
The stupid third movie. Oh, my God, that was bad.
I mean, in the comic book, it seems like
it's like instantaneous, right?
It's a thing. No, it's speed of light. Although Superman... Well, in canon can go faster than the speed of light, but he doesn't do that often because it reverses time. You know, that works.
I love the need to have scientific accuracy in something that is so ludicrous.
Sarah, please.
God, come on. I mean.
Please. I also thought,
like, along similar lines, like, if we had people with mutants or with superpowers who had really good healing, would that impede medicine or medical advances? Because,
of course it would.
You know, we could really cure things if we actually
depends
have
how ubiquitous it
is. Yeah, it depends on how available they are.
It wouldn't.
But strap also, could them down we, and extract them.
Yeah, could we study their methods and mimic them or utilize, you know, could we learn from them?
Yeah, air quotes, that.
Study.
Mm-hmm. Or if it's too advanced, it's indistinguishable from magic, and we can't reverse engineer it.
Yeah, and superpowers, science could not figure out how the superheroes work, and it's, you know, interesting.
That was just side. We don't know.
Yeah, and I think for story's sake, it's sometimes better to not know, because when in stories, they try to tell, they do try to sometimes explain these things, midichlorians,
yeah, it becomes
a disaster, right? I mean, how bad is that?
It's very hard to do that well enough that it's better than just having it being a mystery.
Right. Mm-hmm. And hard science superheroes just would not work. It's just like they would just be boring.
I don't know about that. It would be really challenging. I'd love to see somebody try.
I would find it interesting, but it would not be as nearly as spectacular as the magical abilities that we see now. But I agree. I would like to see somebody do it.
Like actually have to deal with things like inertia.
I don't think it would have broad appeal.
I don't know about that. I mean, if it's good storytelling, it's good storytelling. But like hard science fiction, the physics becomes another character, something else that you have to contend with. You know,
right? How much of that are you seeing these days? Not a lot. Not a lot of good hard sci-fi
because it takes a lot of work. And I think it's just
Expanse.
A lot of Expanse was pretty good. Yeah, and it was great.
They had their gimmies.
They needed a few gimmies.
Well, sure. Even The Martian had its gimmies.
Not too many though.
Yeah, they never solved the space radiation thing. I don't think they went into that.
Well, in the dust storm.
Unless they did in the book. I did not read the book.
Wasn't the whole thing about The Martian, the dust storm, like not reasonable?
No, the ship itself.
Oh, I just mean like there were still gimmies.
The biggest gimme with The Martian was the wind knocking down the damn ship.
That's what I'm trying to say. Yeah, it's the storm. Like that
he admitted
just
that.
That
like,
way.
He just needed a way for that to happen.
He's like, it's a device.
That's fine. That's fine.
Yeah.
If I remember, the RTGs were also like they had to be buried. It had to be buried and far away. It's like no, they're not. They're not dangerous like that. You could be closer to one. You don't have to bury it to be safe. Speaking of, well, that's for the end of the show.
All right, Jay, you're going to start us off with a Swindler's List.
So on Sunday, the 21st of January, a robocall went out to an unknown number of voters in New Hampshire, right? This was last week. The recorded message was from Joe Biden, and he told them not to vote in the primary. The truth is what? That this was not a recording of Joe Biden. It was an AI deepfake.
Ooh, wah, wah.
So take a listen. So somebody created this and sent this out to a bunch of voters.
It's important that you save your vote for the November election. Voting this Tuesday only enables the Republicans in their quest to elect Donald Trump again.
Sounded legit.
Yeah, that wasn't it in its entirety. But basically, you know, people got these phone calls. I don't think that they know how many people responded in the way that the phone call wanted them to. But over a dozen people called in complaining about it.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's an interesting story. So there's an investigation by the New Hampshire Attorney General's office, and they're trying to find out who created the robocall. Attorney General John Formella said that the call falsely appeared to be coming from Kathy Sullivan, who is a former state Democratic Party chair that's involved in a super PAC supporting Biden. That's a pretty interesting little, cranny to this thing, because they had to get her phone number. You know, they had to be able to spoof where the number was coming from. Now, of course, the real issue here is that generative AI technology is it's improving, it's accessible, and right now I could very easily make that phone call myself.
Oh, yeah.
As far as all the phone manipulation that they did, I'm sure with some internet research, I could figure out how to do that too. So basically anybody can do this, make fake political messages and, very soon, believable fake video. You know, that is literally coming in the near future. Everyone's going to be able to make video as well. So experts are warning us that there's going to be an unprecedented election disinformation here in the United States in 2024 due to the AI deepfake technology. This has been happening with elections worldwide. It's not, something that's only happening in the United States, of course. The White House and Biden's campaign manager confirmed that the call was fake. Joe Biden absolutely did not record that. The pathetic thing is, despite the fact that both the Democrats and Republicans here in the United States, both parties are saying that they want to create regulations around AI, nothing has happened yet, which, is to be expected, especially with, the deadlock that the U.S. government is in right now.
Yeah, tend to be reactive.
So proactive. You guys, we all think, yes, we have a problem with disinformation today, but in a few years, it's going to be an absolute nightmare. This is going to be happening all the time. You're never going to be able to trust anything you hear, anything you see. I'm not even sure how we're going to vet whether something is true or not.
We need to run it through other filters that will detect whether it's AI or not, right? You have to.
Sure, but who's going to do that? And on what level would that be done?
That's an arm race that just it's just going to go back and forth, back and forth. There's no we solved that. You'll never be able to always detect it.
It'll be chasing
just a back and forth arms race.
Well, but something has to happen. I mean, if you just let it run wild without going in check, at least, I think that would be worse.
That'd be worse. I agree. You got to do something.
Yeah, you could penalize people heavily on it, but then,
Yeah, we need more tighter laws on this stuff. More
criminal. No, you'll have AI available that's outside of the country.
So, Jay, you said that they're investigating that, but did they say in the article whether or not that was actually illegal? Like, did the people who put out that robocall break any law that they?
Well, that's election tampering, telling somebody not to write something onto a ballot.
Think that would be election tampering, yeah. And unauthorized use of a person.
I mean, there's definitely some laws broken. I'm not exactly sure, and it depends on the state as well.
There might actually be federal things going on there too, because they might have crossed state lines to do it.
Yeah, I wouldn't be surprised.
Yeah.
And if a foreign country did that, what option do we have? Then it's
not much.
Well,
right?
Huh.
That's like cyber warfare. Yeah.
The Trump campaign denied any involvement with the recording. And I believe it. I don't think that the Trump campaign had anything to do with it. But I can also see, though, how tempting this whole thing is going to be for future political campaigns. I mean, super easy to make, not expensive, super incredibly hard to enforce.
Also, even if it gets debunked, the damage is done.
Yeah.
You can't. Yeah, put the genie back. Yeah.
You move the needle by 1-2% in the U.S., and that could be an election.
I mean, we will be having conversations where we say this was fake and all these people believed it and they will never not believe it.
Well, and even if they don't believe it, there is that it's prejudicial. It's like Trump right now during his hearings. Every time he speaks out and they're having to... I don't know what the penalty is, but he's constantly being reprimanded by the judge, because if you just say stuff, then they have to tell the jurors, okay, that's stricken from the record. Pretend you didn't hear that. That's really hard to do.
Mm-hmm.
You can't just unhear something. And I think that our criminal justice system, obviously is a good example of why that it would be really, actually really interesting to see if any sociologists have studied this phenomenon, looking at court cases where things that were prejudicial were said and then stricken, and then seeing how it affected the jurors' decision making. Because I can almost guarantee that you can't unhear things.
Mm-hmm.
How do you even study that?
I'm sure you could come with a psychological paradigm to study that. I think,
for sure. Yeah. You could either induce it, you're right, experimentally, or you could probably study it. You could look at court cases after the fact and compare ones where that happened to ones where it didn't. But yeah, that'd be interesting. I don't know.
Yep. Brave new world.
Oof, it's rough.
All right, Bob, tell us about the oxygen bottleneck. What is that?
Wait, what? Okay, sure.
Who, me?
So Yeah, researchers conclude recently that technological civilizations might need a high but narrow range of oxygen levels in their atmospheres in order to have their own industrial revolutions and develop technologies that we can detect. This was really interesting. The paper was recently published in the journal Nature Astronomy and is called The Oxygen Bottleneck for Technospheres. So yes, in the unending series of news items covering why intelligent life in the universe is either more likely than we thought or less likely than we thought, here's another one for the less likely side of the coin. And I love the name that they came up for it, Oxygen Bottleneck. It sounds like an episode of The Big Bang Theory, doesn't it? So their argument really boils down essentially to one thing, fire. Have you ever thought, here's a thought experiment, have you ever thought of a completely water-based intelligent alien community, completely underwater all the time?
Yes, how I thought limiting, about that.
Yes.
Yes, we have. We have specifically talked to you about that. How limiting would a lack of fire be to their technological development, right? So according to these scientists, this idea applies even to land-based extraterrestrials if they're on a planet without the right amount of atmospheric oxygen. Now, fire, of course, right, it was critical in so many ways. We know this, to keep warm in inhospitable environments, for cooking and getting our bodies and brains more calories. It may have even led to larger brains, right? Cooking and all the extra calories that it provided. We use it to control our environment and hunt. But the most critical application of fire was probably as an energy source, right? Fire, they say in
metallurgy.
Fire, as they say, evolved into more sophisticated uses such as metal smelting, melding, and tool fabrication. Finally, it provided both the energy source and the fuel, for example, charcoal, that initiated the Industrial Revolution and led the Great Acceleration and the Anthropocene, which of course is our current technological or geological age in which humans – I mean, if you could describe the Anthropocene – that's basically the age where humans are the shit, right? That right, we're like, we are it. We are affecting and impacting the world more than basically anything else. So that's why they call it the Anthropocene. So it's an interesting thought, though, trying to imagine an industrial revolution without fire. It's, you know, you got to get really creative to really make that happen, and actually it would be interesting in a story. For that fire to happen, though, you need more than you might think in the atmosphere, but not too much. So too little, like if it's below 18% and it starts getting very, very hard to burn wood or other plant material. But if it gets over 35% oxygen, then you'd never evolve forests or of trees or similar alien plants because they just burn down at the drop of the hat. The authors conclude that the sweet spot for oxygen in the atmosphere is just above 20%. And shocker, guess what the Earth has? It's like 21%. And it's, of course, it's gone up and down. It actually was high. It was up to 35% for a while. It didn't last terribly long. But I mean, for the life of the human evolution, of course, it's been right around where it is now. And the knockout, it never got over 35. If it did, we could have been in trouble in terms of having like trees and stuff like that. So co-author Adam Frank is a professor of astrophysics at the University of Rochester. He said, imagine a young and intelligent species on an alien world with an atmosphere that's just 1% oxygen. Those clever tool-using creatures would never get the chance to watch a tree burn after being hit by lightning and get the idea of using fire for their own purposes. They would never have the chance to learn how fire could be used to cook food or, most importantly, melt metals. The poverty of oxygen in their air would likely box these creatures in forever, limiting their development. It's sad. It's really thinking about that. It's like, oh, man, imagine never even realizing what you're missing out on. It reminds me of – we're talking about The Martian, and him, you guys remember Hail Mary? That's such a good book. There were aliens in his book, in Ware's book Hail Mary, where – they were sound-based, so they never even knew about light in the universe. Everything was – all their knowledge and technology was based on sound. All right, not a perfect analogy, but you get the idea. And the authors looked at alternatives to fire, right? You can't – you know, there's got to be alternatives, right? And yeah, they discuss in their paper focusing stellar light to create energy that way, heat, using geothermal energy, and even using naturally occurring nuclear reactions. All interesting ideas, but then they list the obvious advantages of combustion of biomass, and there's just so many of them. It's globally available. It's self-sustainable. It's portable. It's relatively easy to master and reproduce. So it's kind of hard to disagree with their conclusion that, quote, combustion is the most accessible and versatile means to kickstart the rapid progress of a young civilization. So yeah, it seems pretty pretty critical for any civilization if you really want to, like, as they say, kickstart, you know, your progress. But then the last paragraph of their conclusion, they diverge a little bit. They start examining the implications of the oxygen bottleneck for the search for extra, you know, for evidence of technology on exoplanets. And there are some interesting ramifications. It probably would make sense, right, to prioritize exoplanets that are above the combustion threshold. You know, and if we're trying to evaluate, say, these technosignatures, maybe we would have to assess the credibility of these possible technosignatures through this lens of an oxygen bottleneck. You know, if they had oxygen in their atmosphere, but it was 5%, and you're finding technosignatures, maybe you lower the odds a little bit that these technosignatures are really what they appear to be. Interestingly, this could also help us theoretically. You're familiar with the Drake equation, right? It tries to estimate how many of these detectable technospheres would arise in the universe. This could help inform that. If we determine that planetary evolution results in high oxygen levels only in the rarest of rare cases, that could even give us insight into the Fermi paradox, right? The Fermi paradox asks, where are they, right? And the answer may be, well, there's not too many of them because not many planets actually produce enough oxygen to produce fire that you can then turn and leverage into a technology-based civilization. So, of course, life always finds a way, right?
Mm-hmm.
Right. I wouldn't be surprised if humanity has its own blind spots of possible technological development as well that we've never noticed. You know, there could be unusual forms of life in worlds so alien out there that these technological avenues open up to them that a carbon-based, oxygen-breathing life form would just never consider because of our very nature. But then, of course, physics is physics, even on no matter what planet you're on. And I think, and we know a lot of physics, obviously, so I think it would be hard for some of these avenues to be completely hidden from us forever, right? And it does seem likely that if you're not in that sweet spot of oxygen, it could be very tough. And maybe it would take a very mature civilization, you know, much longer to develop serious technology, like metal-based technology. It would take them quite a long time to get to that point. I mean, imagine if we had no metal-based technology for thousands of years from now until we really figured it out, you know, figured out a way to use other sources of energy besides fire, you know, ubiquitous fire.
Yeah, it's an interesting thought experiment, but I think, you know, you have to say it more as developing technology like
as we
our
know
technology.
It. Exactly, exactly.
Yeah, the thing is, and I thought about this too, like, yeah, couldn't aquatic species like develop spacefaring technology, let's say, but it all depends on, are there other pathways, you know, to developing advanced technology that don't involve metallurgy, you know?
Yeah, there's types of burning that don't need oxygen, but I mean,
or maybe you could have just totally organic-based technology, right?
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. I thought about that, and there are examples in the science fiction literature of that. And the thing is, though, that seems certainly possible to me, right? That certainly seems like an interesting possibility. But I think part of the point there, Steve, is that sure, that could happen, but it's much harder, much, much harder. It would take much more time and development to get to that point, potentially. Who knows?
But is it? Is it harder? We don't know
we're not sure.
N of one.
But it seems, but man, you know, it's definitely, it might not be much, much harder, but I think you could agree that it's harder.
No, I don't agree. I actually don't agree.
Steve.
I think we don't know, Bob. We are so biased by our one pathway to technology. You know, if we had 1,000 civilizations that we could start doing statistics on, then we could make statements about that.
Supercomputers.
We have an N of one. Maybe it's easier to develop biological technology. Who knows?
I disagree. I mean, so you're going to have – how long have we tamed fire? How many millennia have we tamed fire? So you're saying that they –
probably 2 million years.
So they could have started on the pathway of biological technologies millennia ago instead of just taming fire? I mean, I'm not saying –
Bob, we've been cooking food for 2 million years.
Oh, 2 million years. So you're saying they could have started on the pathway of biological technologies – a million years ago. I mean, do you see what I'm saying?
No, I don't. I don't see what you're saying.
Because, Bob, we don't know what their version of fire would be. Like, you're basically saying that fire became, like, the catalyst for all of these other things. But we don't know what
catalyst.
Well,
on Earth it did. We got one data point. Right.
Exactly. So if it was an aquatic world, it was, or an aquatic ecosystem and the intelligent organisms were building organic, I don't know, structures, you know, organic technology.
I'm
we don't know what their fire is.
Yeah, I'm being
like, what if they could harness?
Too.
Yeah, what if they could like
they may be
harness gases and use the gases for something?
Or they may be able to use their own biology to extrude these biological constructs to do weird things. I mean, sure, right. When you consider that, they could potentially take advantage of some sort of biological technology, depending on their actual. But their weird biology that we just can't even imagine right
or
now.
Or just
sure,
what's on
that.
Their planet. Like, you know, we're at a stage now where a lot of our very advanced technology requires all of these like minerals and metals that we have to like excavate from the planet. Like they're not things we can make. We have to find them.
Imagine being on a planet that's so metal poor that you're just like, oh boy, no natural resources. That's another discussion.
Yeah, that'd
right
be
there.
A huge
that
bottleneck.
That would be horrible. Can you imagine? Ugh.
But again, from our perspective, you're correct. And again, I would love to. This is the thing that we will never see,
right.
Like statistics on. Like, yeah, what if you grew up in a planet that has a surface gravity of 2? Do they never go into space because chemical rockets can't get you there? If they're metal poor, do they never develop technology because they have no pathway through metallurgy?
Right.
Yeah.
Or is there an oxygen bottleneck, or are there so many different pathways that they always find a way?
But Steve,
you know?
I do kind of agree with Bob on that. Like when you said, "Yeah, again, you know, we don't know." He said metals, but then immediately after that, he did say, "Imagine living on a planet that was poor in how did you word it, Bob?
Mineral."
No, you metals. Said just natural resources.
Yeah.
And if you think about it that way, that's a pretty broad statement. Whatever natural resources are necessary for their development, I don't see how you could have advanced technology on a planet where
Well, you got to have something.
Exactly.
Saying lacks resources is a really broad statement.
True, but that's probably the broadest bottleneck out there.
Yeah, sure. Resource bottleneck?
Right.
Sure, I think I buy that in principle. But again, getting back to the oxygen bottleneck, that seems to me to be highly specific for one pathway to technology. And we just don't know if that is the easiest path or if it's just the one that we took because it would, for us, that was the pathway of least resistance. You know, if you have a planet on which you can easily combust stuff, sure, that's probably going to be your preferred pathway to technology, especially if you have if it's metal rich.
Well,
and
things combusted naturally. Like you said, Bob, like that was something we harnessed.
Yeah, like if you, you never saw lightning hit a tree and like, holy crap, look at that. What is
How
that?
Do we use that?
Oh my God, could you imagine that day for humanity when that first time that happened?
Bob,
but
maybe they invented waterproof matches. You just don't know.
I could believe that that's the case. I just don't think we can assume that it is because I could also believe, for example, that another species might – looking at people on Earth goes like, oh my God, they never developed this resin-based technology. How did that happen?
Right.
Oh, it's because they had this weird sweet spot where they could burn metals, you know, that is rare.
Yeah, absolutely.
So they never took this other obvious pathway to technology that most other civilizations do or whatever.
I think we won't know. We won't know any of that until
that's what I mean.
Until we can simulate evolution. Just here's the laws of physics. Evolve and to see what life forms evolve, you know, in silico and see what happens.
We need more powerful computers.
What do you think will come first, though? Do you think discovery or simulation?
Simulation. Absolutely.
So unless the Encyclopedia Galactica is beaming down to us right now and we just
don't know how to read it.
You just have to find it and everything. That would be nice. Like, oh, here's the history of the universe. Here's, you know, what the last 10,000 civilizations
were. It's embedded
in
every neutrino.
That'd be nice,
right,
but
there.
I think we're going to have to wait for simulation.
Yeah, probably. All right. Thanks, Bob. Jay, tell us about NASA finally opening the OSIRIS-REx canister.
Yeah, so a quick refresher, guys. You know, NASA's OSIRIS-REx mission. You know, we sent a rover to asteroid Bennu back in September 8th, 2016. Now, that's a long time ago at this point. So it arrived near the asteroid December 2018, and the samples were finally collected after a brief touchdown on October 20th, 2020. So it was there for, you know, a couple of years. something, you know, sussing out the asteroid, you know, picking a place to land and everything. Now, this is important because this was the first U.S. return mission from an asteroid. The capsule containing the asteroid sample came back to Earth on September 24, 2023, you know, not that long ago, and we were all excited, and mm-hmm. they said that they had 70.3 grams of rock and dust, and then they couldn't open it. So the problem was that two of the 35 fasteners that were on the probe that was sent back that had the samples in it, they were not releasing, and NASA tried, you know, using all these different pieces of equipment that they had to try to get it open. The confounding issue, though, was that they wanted to keep the sample inside the canister free from contamination, of course, because you don't want Earth microbes to get in there and then you don't know what you're looking at. So the team at NASA's Johnson Space Center had to design and build some new tools to specifically help the effort to get the canister open. So the challenge was not just opening the fasteners, but doing so in a way that wouldn't compromise the scientific integrity of the samples. And that was their number one priority. And it took a long time, and they did it. So the new tools needed to be made from materials that were approved for curation and could function within this confined space that they had. They call it like a specialized glove box that they had it in. So this glove box was treated with a constant flow of nitrogen, which prevented Earth's atmosphere from contaminating the sample. And just as an example, you know, you take a sample of air, you know, especially close to the, close to the ground. I mean, there is an incredible amount of debris in the air everywhere. There is, you know, there are molds and pollen and all sorts of stuff, right? So they don't want any of this stuff in there. So
dander,
yeah, everything. It's just, you know, we're in a constant sea of just junk floating in the air that
we're
breathing
in. Soup, basically. Yep,
bacteria clouds.
So what they did was they created two tools that they needed new bits made from surgical non-magnetic stainless steel, and these tools were designed to fit into this glove box, remove the fasteners, and allow for the safe disassembly of the canister head. And they finally got it open on January 10th, 2024. So NASA intends to catalog all the Bennu samples later this year, and this catalog is going to be available globally, which is really cool. So they're going to allow scientists and other institutions, you know, they can request samples and, you know, for research, for display, you know, these samples will probably be over the globe this year, you know, just from them sending stuff out, which is really cool. You might be able to see some of this in a museum. So Bennu itself is a carbon-rich asteroid, and it's remained largely unchanged over the 4.5 billion years that it's been around. And studying the samples that we took from it could definitely provide us some cool insights into the, you know, the formation and the evolution of all the celestial bodies that we have in the universe. You know, it enhances our understanding of the universe, basically, which is great. And we, you know, as much as this type of thing, it's not going to really answer any big questions like where did we come from and all that, but it is going to answer some questions for us to help us have a clearer picture of what the universe is that we live in. So
yeah, and the early solar system as well.
Exactly right, Bob. I forgot to mention that the early solar system is a part of what we want to understand. So now there's another cool part to this whole thing, and I had no idea about any of this. So did you guys know that the OSIRIS-REx spacecraft is still out there, and it's heading to another asteroid? Did you guys know that?
Mm-hmm. I think I recall that.
The ship didn't land in the traditional sense, like if you think of like a, you know, moon lander, and it's coming down, and, you know, they're slowly descending, and then they finally rest on the planet, and it's just sitting there. It did something called a touch and go. So the asteroid mm-hmm. has low gravity. So the ship located a good landing spot, ridiculous, which took a long time. It lightly touches down on the surface, like barely touches the surface of the asteroid. And then it blasts the surface of the asteroid with nitrogen gas. This kicks up all this dust and small rocks. And then as that all settles back down, they had their collection pan there waiting for stuff to fall into it. So then that seals up. The ship left the asteroid, and then it shot back the canister back to Earth. Now, they renamed the ship because it's heading to an asteroid called Apophis.
Yep.
Apophis.
The one that's kind of
infamous.
To have a close encounter with Earth in 2029, I think.
I pronounced it correctly. Thank you. Thank you, Kara. I appreciate that. I'm like, I have a 1 in 5 chance of pronouncing this word correctly. So this asteroid has some close approaches to Earth, and we've been wanting to study it, and we want to know what it's made out of. And, you know, the more we know, the better, right? It does have a potential impact on the planet in the distant future. And the spacecraft now is renamed OSIRIS APEX, which is just so cool, right? Like, this ship is this
new mission, new name. Yeah. That's right.
And it's got solar panels, and it has plenty of energy to continue going on. And I just think it's pretty cool. I would love one day, guys, if we were at a museum to be seeing a piece of that asteroid.
Yeah.
Yeah. Not touching
an
asteroid.
I think we will someday. Yeah. We got to smell the early universe. Remember?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's very cool.
Yeah. It smelled kind of like a barbecue.
All right, Kara, tell us about learning and longevity.
Yeah, this is a really interesting study that was just published in The Lancet Public Health, called Effects of Education on Adult Mortality, a Global Systematic Review and Meta-Analysis. And this was published by a collaboration between the IHME, which is the Institute for Health Metrics and Evaluation at the University of Washington, and CHAIN, which stands for the Center for Global Health Inequalities Research, and that is at the Norwegian University of Science and Technology. So there's like a ton of authors on this study. And I just want to qualify at the beginning that this is one of those news items where, like, I'm going to tell you something we already knew. We just know it way better now.
Yeah.
And that's really what's going on here. We always knew that education was associated with lowered all-cause mortality, meaning that of any reason, people stay alive longer. They don't die younger if they are more educated, that there's a really obvious, and it's been measured hundreds, actually thousands, based on this study, thousands of times in the literature. But
so, Kara, what you're saying is that if people listen to the SGU, they will live longer.
Never studied that. We're talking,
but we can extrapolate
that from the data.
That's not unfair.
Yeah, right.
It's not unreasonable.
Not unreasonable at all.
I'm going to go with that.
Yeah, we'll go with that. We'll go with that. News story over. Moving on. So basically, we've known for a long time that education is correlated with reduction of the risk of death. What this study wanted to say is, like, how much so? Like, let's look at a big analysis across, they started with like thousands of studies. They brought it down quite a bit by excluding a lot of, you know, just like poorly designed studies and repetition. But they still were looking at thousands of data points by the end of this. And they found some really interesting outcomes. So let's talk about them. Regardless of age, sex, race or ethnicity, marital status, income, occupation, employment status, we found that there's a large correlation between lowered mortality or reduction in the risk of death and education. On average, each additional year of education decreases the risk of death by 2%.
Whoa.
But there are big kind of breaks in that. There are these sort of points in the education where we see a more significant change. So I want to go over that part first. Okay, and I have it highlighted.
I assume they factored for, like, the more education you have, the more, you know, disposable income you probably have, which also can, you know, affect.
Yeah, you said income, right?
Yeah, income is a big part. Yeah, they controlled for income.
Okay.
They controlled. And the way that they describe their controls is really interesting because this is a global study. So socioeconomic status or these kind of social variables, they're going to differ across different nations. So whereas in, you know, there were two African nations that they looked at, they were actually controlling for things like wealth. In other nations, they were controlling for things like poverty, or they were controlling for things like whether or not somebody was actively employed. So it's not standardized across, but they did look at income across all individuals. And then they tried to make those comparisons clearly within the culture or the society where those people lived. Now, I do want to do another caveat here because you brought that up, which is that this was heavily focused, and this is a bias. It's an intrinsic bias, but it's not because the researchers chose not to look at the studies that weren't out of this region. It's because those studies don't exist, but it's heavily biased on what they call the GBD, that's the Global Burden of Disease quantification of wealthy nations. So most of these studies that have been published took place in like European, Americas, Australia, New Zealand. There are studies in other parts of the world that were included, but their numbers are significantly smaller. So the researchers do say in their discussion, we would love to see more data in significantly poorer countries, but that's not to say that that the data don't point to the fact that this would be the same or even more of a significant change in those regions. So even in very, very rich nations where a lot of the people are educated, we see significant differences based on how educated they are after controlling for all those things I mentioned before. So compared with no education, this is pulled straight from the results section of the paper. Compared with no education, completing 6 years of education. So what they're saying is across the world, that's roughly a primary school education. That's associated with a 13.1% reduction in mortality risk after controlling for age, sex, and marital status. The reduction in mortality risk was 24.5% after 12 years of education. So that's approximately secondary school. And then we saw another significant break after 18 years of education. Now that's a lot of education. That would be like for our listeners here in the US, that would be elementary, middle, high school, college, and then at least 2 years of graduate school or more specialized training. I know that those things are called different things across the world. So that's quite a bit of education, 18 years, but that was associated with a 34.3% reduction in mortality risk. So on average, it was about 2% per year of education, but we did see these kind of breaks in the data. Here's something really interesting. The health benefits of education are comparable to massive lifestyle factors. So the researchers actually compared lifestyle factors. And I want to kind of just tell you a couple of them because they are pretty mind-boggling.
So Steve could like smoke and drink his face off and he'd be fine?
Well, no. If
he would balance out.
It might balance out. Steve's even better because he doesn't do those things. Mm-hmm. So they found that, for example, 18 years of education. So remember, that's significant. That's the one that I mentioned is, you know, we're into graduate school by that point, can be compared to that of eating a healthy and recommended like dose of vegetables every day as opposed to not eating vegetables at all.
Wow, that's big.
Yeah. So if somebody with no education is more like somebody who doesn't eat any vegetables, somebody with 18 years is more like somebody who eats vegetables every day. Here's another one. Not going to school at all, so no education, is as bad for you as drinking 5 or more alcoholic drinks a day or smoking a half a pack a day for 10 years. Mm-hmm. That's the comparable effect, or I should say protective effect, that education has. Here's something else that's kind of interesting. We do see a more significant protective effect in young people as expected, but even in older people, we see a big change. Over 50 and even over 70, we see a big change. So it's still protective for mortality at that level. And so, of course, the authors of this study, you know, the big takeaway that they say is this needs to be a massive area of economic development across the globe. You know, we often talk about preventive strategies and policy decisions for lowering mortality, right? For people healthy and for, you know, increasing their longevity. But we don't often think about the fact that education in and of itself does that. And if we talk about why it does that, like, do you guys have some ideas why people who are more educated live longer?
I mean, is this a reverse Darwin effect that we're seeing? I mean, more educated people are just less likely to do stupid, risky things. That'd be one idea. I mean, obviously there could be confounding factors galore, but it sounds like they controlled for most of the obvious ones, you know, like access to healthcare, access to, you know, better socioeconomic status.
And of course, they saw that those factors are deeply implicated, right? But you're right, that the effect still exists on top of that, but they are attenuated deeply. So if you think about it, you're right. People with a lower education are probably going to make poorer decisions with regards to a lot of things, and maybe right. poor like risk-seeking decisions. But really, what they mention here is like, okay, more education, you're gonna have more employment, right? The longer you're employed, the more you're employed, the more money you're gonna make, as we said before. But also, you're gonna have better access to healthcare. You're gonna be more. Yeah. You're gonna be able to make more informed mm-hmm. decisions about your healthcare. They also mentioned that people who are highly educated, usually they just have more coping mechanisms. They have more psychological resources. They have more social circles. And we know that those things are also implicated in longevity. A lot less pseudoscience, probably more educated people, especially I would argue educated women, are going to be more informed about their reproductive health. And they're going to be able to make decisions, hopefully, that prevent a lot of in 50% of the population, we know that a lot of reasons that women die young have to do with reproduction. And so I think across the board, more education, it just affects people's lives in the positive on almost every factor that you could measure.
Yeah. And I could tell you, and I know there's data on this, but also anecdotally as a physician, that better educated patients just interact a lot better with the healthcare system.
Completely.
And all sorts of subtle ways, you know. It's almost like it's hard to quantify, but it's like they're just more compliant. They make better decisions. They do so many things that is better for them in terms of their healthcare.
Mm-hmm. Just understanding, you know, really understanding what's going on, because it's very hard. Yeah. You know, we've all done things in our lives where we make decisions and we have behaviors based on reason and logic, you know. We've all been in situations where we've made decisions and we've changed our behaviors based on sort of like just following the rules, right? I was told that this is how I have to do it. I have to do it. We've all been in situations like that. In an airplane, for example, you have to do things a certain way. You're like, this is stupid and antiquated. And if it were up to me, I would do it this other way, but I have to just follow the rules. And I think that's a good example of what you're talking about, Steve, for people who are less educated mm-hmm. and don't understand, you know, why if I do X is Y going to be the result. They're just going to do it because they were told to do it. But that means that if there's a slight shift, they're not going to be able to modulate around that shift. It's going to be more black mm-hmm. and white thinking, more concrete thinking. And obviously, education leads to more flexible thinking. It leads to better cognitive flexibility. But I think it also leads to more self-advocacy. It leads to a mm-hmm. sense of agency. You know, all of these things are going to be associated with living longer. And so that's really the big outcome here, is like very often we argue from a geopolitical perspective for education for a number of sort of social and civil reasons, but we should also be talking about it from a pure like global health burden perspective. Mm-hmm. Education saves lives. And I don't think we make that connection as often as we probably should.
Yeah. I mean, it's better for people individually and for society mm-hmm. in so many ways.
Absolutely.
Education is just a boon to any society.
Yep.
It is probably the best single investment that mm-hmm. any society can make in its own people.
Agree. You know? Agree.
All right. What do you guys know about DNA directed assembly?
Assembly
like nanomachines? So, Kara, this is in your favorite discipline of material science.
Oh, that kind of assembly. Okay.
Yeah.
So I was like, all assembly in your body is DNA directed.
No, this is using DNA for the assembly of inorganic materials, which has actually been going on for about 10 years. This is something that we were actively using in industry. But there's a recent paper looking at ways to make this DNA-directed assembly programmable and more powerful. So this is something I had very little awareness of the details of this, so I thought it was very interesting. So what the researchers did is they essentially used the DNA-directed assembly. This is basically a form of self-assembly. And the idea here is that, you know, we're trying to build things at the nanoscale, right? And we've talked about the fact before that this is the new age of material science, is manipulating the structure of materials at the nanoscale.
That's awesome.
Yeah, this is how you get to metamaterials, which have interesting properties, again, that go beyond the properties of the stuff itself, but properties that derive from the nanoscale structure, but also, you know, just the ability to create combinations of materials at the nanoscale that could have programmable properties. Like if we say, oh, we need this to be more conducting or more insulating or respond to a magnetic field or not, or whatever, stronger, harder, more ductile. The basic process is that you build a scaffold or, right, or some kind of structure. They make an analogy like this is like the frame of the house, right? And then, of course, you install things in the frame for whatever specific properties you want. And that is where the DNA-directed self-assembly comes in. And they could work with all kinds of materials for this, you know, both metals, metal oxides, and other specific alloys or metal oxides. I say like platinum, aluminum, doped zinc oxides, like that kind of stuff. They can get really, really specific. Then they do one of two things. They either did a gas infusion or a liquid infusion. And they're exactly what they sound like. With the gas infusion, you basically use whatever element you want to infuse into that framework in a gas phase. And that can penetrate deeply into the structure. Like, if I want to put aluminum atoms deep within the structure, you could basically make a gas phase of whatever, and it assembles inside the nanostructure. Then the liquid phase is another way to do this, but that tends to deposit things more on the outside. So by using a combination of those two, you could then get to this three-dimensional programmable structure embedded with whatever other elements you need in order to create the properties that are desirable. The goal here is also, again, these kinds of things are being used, but they're trying to like put it all together in this study to show that, you know, how much control you actually can have, right? You can create these 3D nanostructured inorganic materials that have programmable properties, but also they're trying to refine the procedure so that it can scale, right? Because if you can't do this on an industrial scale, then it may be great for making specific one-off things for NASA, you know, that they're going to send into space, but it's not going to be sitting on your desktop, right? It's not going to be the kind of thing that's going to be like a computer chip in every device or every computer. But if you can get to the point where this is a scalable industrial process, and it also means it has to be cheap, right? It's got to be inexpensive and scalable, then this is
change the world.
Yeah, then that will change the world, right? Then you know, we could mass produce these things. So this is really what we need to do in order to be able to take a lot of our technologies to the next level, right? Because, you know, there's only so many alloys. I mean, there's a lot of alloys, but, you know, and we are still yeah, discovering new alloys. But the thing is, like, there's only so many elements. Like, you can't discovering a new element is not going to get us in it, because either we've discovered them all. The only ones that, you know, at the high end of the periodic table are just very large and unstable, right? We're not going to be building stuff out of them.
Well, probably not.
Yeah, Bob, probably not.
Islands of stability, you know, I'm not ruling that out.
They're just relative stability. They're not again, you're not going to build stuff out of it. It's like, oh, it survived for 20 nanoseconds instead of only 1 nanosecond. No,
we don't know. It could be more dramatic than that. But yeah, I mean, it's not likely. But
yeah,
it's,
milliseconds.
I'm holding out.
Yeah. No. Yeah, I'm not holding out any hope. You know, yeah, sure, alloys. Sure, we do have these super alloys that, you know, like have extreme heat resistance. So there's still, I think, some advances to be made there. But mostly, I think, going to the next level of super materials is going to involve the nanostructure, right? That is where those super properties are going to come from. And really, we're just getting started, you know, with that whole line of technology. And this kind of thing, so self-assembly is like one of those key concepts. Because at the nanoscale, like, there's only so much you could do to place individual atoms where you need them to go. You know what I mean? Like, that's not how we're going to be doing things. You need to create the manufacturing method has to have some kind of self-assembly in there. Things have to put themselves together. And we just need to figure out how to direct that self-assembly. And that's where the DNA comes in. You know, using DNA, because DNA is programmable when you think about it, right? We could build DNA with any structure that we need. And then, so that becomes like the template that directs the self-assembly of the materials that we need. So the whole concept is very, very cool. This may not be the precise methods that will ultimately be used, you know, in mass production, but I think we're getting pretty close. And again, some of these technologies are already in use, like they're already being used. But this is just taking it to the next level. So I think this is, you know, we're going to be seeing a lot more of this in the future. And this could be like the next, you know, real revolution in material science. That's going to be like one day, be like, oh my God, everything is made of this stuff. You know what I mean? It's like plastic was, you know, whatever, 50 years ago, 60 years ago.
Oh.
No, just in the good way, there's always a bad way too. But I mean, like in the good way that plastic was a revolution. You know what I mean? Like the ability
to. Oh, sure was.
I mean,
yeah.
It still is.
Right.
I mean it's, you know, it's an incredible material.
Yeah.
You know, we just.
Oh, world changing.
Yeah. We're not handling the production of it well. You know, we're not handling like.
So revolutionary that we took it for granted.
Yeah, it was too successful.
Like, we deeply took it for granted.
It was too successful to if we don't know what to do with all the stuff that we're making. It's so cheap to make. It has so many desirable properties. And it's going to be the same thing. You know, like we also talk about carbon nanofibers, carbon nanotubes, et cetera. Same thing, although, you know, we're still trying to figure out, you know, how to get, you know, how to mass produce those with the right properties, et cetera. But I think the future technology is going to largely be made of metamaterials that are self-assembled at the nanoscale using these kinds of techniques. You know,
yeah, I mean? We could see some real dramatic stuff with metamaterials. We're just scratching the surface with that as well.
Cloak of invisibility.
Yeah. No, yeah. Yeah. Whenever you read anything like that, like about tiny, tiny lenses or invisibility cloaks, whatever that, you know, even though that's hype, the way that's sold, that's all metamaterials. Yeah, absolutely. All right, Evan.
Yep.
Tell us about this bleach peddler.
The what? Bleach peddler.
The bleach peddler.
Well, I'll start with a saying, because there's an old saying in the world of board games. Go to jail, go directly to jail. Perhaps you're familiar with that one. And sometimes life can be like a board game.
Do not pass go.
That's right. And do not collect $200. And sometimes life can be like a board game, especially when you choose in the real world to sell fake and dangerous COVID cures to people. Go to jail. And that's what happened just this past week in New Zealand. Yep, we're talking about the worldwide scam that, I don't know, seems to know no boundaries. Miracle Mineral Solution. MMS.
That's crazy.
Boy, this thing
which
just
is literally
comes up
just
all the
bleach.
Time.
It's industrial bleach.
It's bleach. But the people at MMS want you to buy their bleach and drink it so you can do away with your COVID. And before COVID was, you know, kind of the thing it is now, they wanted you to drink it to get rid of malaria or
whatever.
Cure your HIV, right? Common colds, autism, and of course, cancer, among many other things that they said it would help you with, right? So MMS, Miracle Mineral Solution, it's sodium chloride, and the end user combines it with hydrochloric acid or citric acid, and that creates chlorine dioxide. Now, chlorine dioxide, that's not just your run-of-the-mill, over-the-counter, regular Clorox bleach. Nope, it's used for industrial-grade purposes, sterilizing machinery and industrial surfaces, among other things. Now, this latest news concerning this poison is that a fellow in New Zealand has been found guilty. He was brought up on 29 charges, most of which were counts of what they're calling breach of the Medicines Act in New Zealand, and a few other counts, obstruction of ministry officials, and making false statements. But 29 charges in all, this person has been found guilty, and the other day the sentence was handed down. Now he's going to jail. Actually, he's been in custody for about 4 weeks, but his sentence is now official.
Evan, I have to be pedantic because you left the door open for me to be so. He's going to prison. I'm assuming he already was in jail.
He's being held.
The
last 20
jail
years.
is where you are held before you are sentenced. But once you're sentenced, you go to prison.
I use them.
A lot of people use those two words interchangeably, but they're different.
Yeah, they mean different things. You get the idea.
Yeah, as I said, I'm being pedantic just to be pedantic. But
can you not have a jail? Is there ever a jail sentence?
Held in jail, I
know what you mean. That's and that does happen all the time. But I think people can get jail time.
I just think people are using that term loosely.
Right.
Yeah. If you are convicted, you are sent to prison.
Right.
Well, thanks for heading off the 100 emails we were about to get on that, Steve.
That's part of the reason.
Totally get what you're doing there. Absolutely. All right. So who is this person? His name is Roger Blake. And he is to New Zealand what Mark Grennan is to the United States. Now, you recall back in 2022, Mark Grennan, along with his two sons, were found guilty of crimes and imprisoned for selling MMS bleach to their victims. Mark Grennan was sentenced to 13 years in prison for his actions. The sons each got 5-year sentences. But you know how Mark Grennan tried to defend himself in court as I was reading up on this? He defended himself, First Amendment, freedom of religion. Mm-hmm. That was his defense. So, not even here in the United States, where freedom to practice religion, that is not a legal shield against fraud and injuring others. So, yes, we have freedom of religion, but not to that extent, thank goodness. Roger Blake, so he's got his own thing going on. He's been in the bleach selling racket for quite a while, and he's been previously warned from New Zealand Ministry of Health officials about promoting this product as far back as 2009. And at that time, he was claiming it was a cure for cancer. And since then, he had suffered warnings again no less than 5 more times over the next 10 years. Now, a fat lot of good all those warnings did, because it really didn't deter him. But he was very sneaky and sort of cunning about selling his products. The website that he used to peddle this stuff is not based in New Zealand. So there was limited jurisdiction as what could really be done to him. Plus, he was combining the sale of the MMS bleach with the selling of other products having to do with actual water purification, legitimate products. So he used that kind of as a means to cloak his quackery under an umbrella of legitimacy. And that, you know, kind of obfuscated things. It was not the easiest thing to directly uncover. But who owned the website overseas? Yep, Mark Grennan himself. And he was hosting that site out of the Dominican Republic. So, you know, kind of these jurisdictional issues at play here. Roger Blake has said there's thousands of New Zealanders who have used this product as an alternative health treatment on the theory that if the chemicals purify drinking water, they can also detoxify humans who are 70% water. That's a direct quote.
Do you know what that reminds me of?
Wow.
That reminds me of when Trump was like, can't you just like shine a UV light inside of your body?
Oh my gosh.
Oh, he mentioned bleach then as
He did mention bleach. He did.
Bleach, you're right.
He did. And, yeah. You know, oh boy. I mean, thank goodness he didn't really go much further.
And you could see like the medical expert behind him was like,
doing a face palm. Right?
Yeah.
Oh my gosh. He also said, I don't always hear what people want it for, and then when people place an order, I don't know what they are using it for, but I would say 5% of them use it for autism curing. Mm-hmm. But most of it's cancer. I personally know people who have gotten rid of their cancer within a few weeks, all without those horrible side effects that you get from the mainstream options. We've had people who have cured their cancer for under $20. Isn't that great?
Wow.
Yeah, there's no evidence whatsoever, by the way. I think we officially have to say this, that MMS or chlorine dioxide works against pathogens or toxins in the body when consumed. In fact, they say ingesting these products can cause dangerous and potentially life-threatening side effects, such as acute liver failure, among other things.
I mean, now, did he have a body count? I mean, you're telling people to drink bleach and they're doing it. I mean, there's got to be some body count,
right?
Yeah,
there must be people who died from that.
So in the article, they're saying that they cannot trace back a death or a significant injury that anybody has put in or claimed was a result of having consumed his product.
But that's not in
New Zealand, right? Okay, but that's not what the charges were brought up for. He was warned many times to stop this, and he basically ignored all the warnings. And it all came to a head with COVID because he had sold roughly $149,000 U.S. between December of 2019 and March of 2020, which was, you know, like peak COVID hysteria. And the authorities basically said, that's enough. We're going after you now, and we're gonna take you to the mat. It took a while. They did it. He had his trial. They found him guilty. 29 counts against him. However, 10.5 months in jail. That is the sentence.
Paltry. We also don't know how, like, obviously New Zealand's justice system works, but yep. I just looked it up to be even more pedantic, Steve.
Yeah.
It's jail if the sentence is less than a year.
Oh, yeah, is that right?
So, you go to jail to await, obviously, your trials or your bail hearings. But if you're convicted, if your sentence is less than a year, you spend it in jail. Anything over a year, you spend in prison here in the U.S.
Mm-hmm. All right, that makes sense.
But it's
because jail is short term. Yeah, yeah,
it's short term. Yeah. And it's minimum security. Like, it's a completely different thing. And it's usually run
by, like, a sheriff by, like, holding you.
Yeah, it's run by the local jurisdiction. Mm-hmm. Yeah, as opposed to the state or the federal.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But who knows? In New Zealand, it might be completely different.
So, some comeuppance, I suppose. I don't, who knows? He'll barely be back on the street next year doing this again, I'm afraid.
That's the hard thing when, like, charlatans are operating rogue outside of a regulated position. Like, you know, we hear these horror stories about actual licensed physicians doing terrible things, but at least we can revoke their licenses.
Yeah.
That has teeth.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But, like, when somebody is doing something that they don't need a license to do it, you're right. They can always just keep doing it a different way. Just so scary.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, the powers that be underestimate how sociopathic these people are,
mm-hmm.
you know?
Yeah.
I mean, do they really have to wait until somebody actually dies that they can pin that crime onto this person?
Unfortunately, that often makes it easier, you know?
Sad.
But the good news is, I mean, there is precedent. People have died from this very solution in Absolutely. Other countries.
Mm-hmm. Yes, they have.
Mm. All right, thanks, Evan.
Yep.
Jay, it's Who's That Noisy Time.
All right, guys, last week I played this noisy. Any idea, guys?
That sounded like C-3PO when he got shot on Cloud City in Bespin, when Chewbacca was putting him back together in his head.
Yeah,
you know?
Sort of.
Oh, yeah, a little bit of that. A
little bit. I know that's not what it is, but that's what it reminded me of.
They were saying actual words, whatever it was, right?
Maybe. Let's see what the listeners think. So a listener named Frederick Naya, he gave me the pronunciation of his name, and I can't pronounce it. N-A-Y-A-W-H.
A-W-H.
Naya. All right, Frederick Naya. He said, "Hello, oh my birds, I have not heard that noise in ages. This is a slowed-down, degraded, pull-to-speak doll from the late 80s and early 90s. And then he goes on, "I will even wager that this is specifically from the 1990 Blue Bart Simpson pull-to-speak doll." So I remember these weird dolls where you pull on a string and then the string, you know, goes back up into the doll. And as it does it, something is spinning in there that's making some talking noise. And this is a very good guess. I've heard it. I know exactly what you're talking about, but this is not correct.
That's remember
not
the Barbie doll? Like, math is hard or something. I don't know if that's exactly what it was, but
horrible.
Oh my gosh.
Absolutely horrible.
Jim Kelly wrote in and said, "Hi, Jay. My guess on this week's Who's That Noisy is that this is a cockatiel. It's possible that this is the cockatiel that was affectionately known as Rose Dale, who lived in the Haight-Ashbury region of San Francisco during the 1960s. I'm not surprised that some people guessed birds. This is most definitely not a bird. But, you know, if you guessed bird every time, you'd be right a lot of the times. So many cool noises come from birds. Another listener named Micah Swindles said, "Hey, Jay, I think this week's noisy is someone tightening cable ties." Whoa. Now, I consider this guess to be a close one, guys, right? He's saying somebody's tightening cable ties, you know, like a zip tie.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Damn, nice.
Zip. And I'm submitting this answer from Wainuiomata in New Zealand. Wainuiomata. Okay, I pronounced it right. Everybody's giving me pronunciations now when they write in. Yes, it's my weakness. So
mangle my name.
I have a winner. I will tell you before I give you the answer, I'll tell you that I have never heard of or seen this thing before. It's one of the reasons why I picked it. A listener named Shane Hillier wrote in and said, "J-Bones, it's a balloon ribbon that's been given ridges as to produce the sound Happy New Year. When one places the ribbon between their forefinger and thumbnail, with some pressure and pulls lengthwise down the ribbon, right? So it's like, imagine a zip tie and you're holding it in one hand and then you run your fingernail down the length of it as you pull it away, right?
Mm-hmm.
Apparently, you're supposed to do this next to a balloon because the balloon will actually reverberate the sound and make it a lot louder. But they're able to, in the bumps and ridges on that piece of plastic, when your fingernail rubs up against them, it actually makes the sound it makes a sound of like words. So here it is. It's saying Happy New Year. And the person is using this the way I described. He's running his fingernail down along the length of this piece of plastic.
Oh, wow.
And now you can hear it, right? That's like the audio pareidolia. Now that you know what it's supposed to say, your brain totally hears it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so, I mean, I don't know if any of you guys ever saw these. I never saw these. I never heard about these things. But it's pretty cool. I'd definitely like to try one. I don't even know if you can get these anymore, but it'd be pretty cool to try it out. Anyway, so this Noisy was sent in by a listener named Yair Eshel last week. That's cool. Thank you so much for sending that in. You showed me something brand new. I never even heard of those before. I have a new Noisy for you guys this week. And this Noisy is sent in by a listener named Victor Weindlmayer. All right.
GTA.
If you guys think GTA 5, if you guys think you know what this week's Noisy is, or you have heard something cool and you want me to consider playing it on the show, you got to email me at wtn@theskepticsguide.org. Steve, tickets have been flying off the shelves for our two shows. Yeah, this is really cool. So I think that we are far enough away from the pandemic where people are actually starting to go to shows again.
Mm-hmm.
Yay.
Taylor Swift doesn't seem to have a ticket sale problem. Mm-hmm. But
is she coming to the show in Dallas?
So if you are interested in seeing the SGU when we're in Dallas, guys, there are still tickets for the Extravaganza, which is our stage show. That's like a improv comedy / science-based show. It lasts, it's over an hour and a half, little more. And we will basically show you how you cannot trust your perception, right? Your brain is flawed and it fools you all the time. And we will show you many ways how your brain can fool you.
If you're a geek, you'll love it.
Yeah, it's fun. We're laughing the whole time. It's a great night. So you could go check that out. Unfortunately, the private show tickets are sold out big time. Like those tickets like flew. Like I couldn't believe it. It was awesome, right? Because so many people there haven't seen us. We've never been. So I guess a lot of people have been waiting for us to come to Texas, and that's what happens.
But, plus the Eclipse was very cooperative, you know.
Yeah. Well, yeah. There's gonna be more.
It was
people
like
in
perfectly
town, I'm sure.
Timed on a Monday, you know.
Yeah.
So,
if you'd like to see us at the Extravaganza, George Robb is the host of that show. All five of the Rogues will be there. And you can go to theskepticsguide.org, and there's a button on there that you can press for the Extravaganza, and you can find out more, and you can buy tickets. Evan, why don't you tell us about who will be appearing at the private show with us?
At the private show on Sunday, April 7th, we're going to have a very special guest. His name is Dustin Bates. And he's the lead singer of the group called Starset. So for you Starset fans out there, this is going to be your chance to say hello and meet Dustin Bates, lead singer. He's going to join us. He's going to be our special guest joining us for the recording of the episode. And he's an admirer of the SGU. He loves science. He loves technology. He loves future discussions and future talks, which I know is something we all love as well. And it's going to be a tremendous amount of fun to have Dustin Bates on the show.
Yeah, definitely cool. Looking forward to it. And again, unfortunately, that show is sold out. But if you have tickets, you will definitely get to meet and see Dustin. So a few things, guys.
Yeah.
It's the new year. We have a crazy year ahead of us, especially here in the United States. You know, no matter what you believe, it's going to be a crazy year. But the one thing that stands firm during all these times is that critical thinking is incredibly important. It's something that everyone that listens to this show, you know, I'm sure you have an understanding of what it is.
And it makes you live longer.
And apparently it makes you live longer.
Science says so.
We take the work that we do here very seriously. We know that it's meaningful, and that's why we've been doing this for 19 years. If you would like to show your support, which we could absolutely use, please consider becoming a patron of this show. You can go to patreon.com/skepticsguide. We have different levels. You will gain access to our Discord, which we have an unbelievable community of people there. A lot of people from our Discord, our Patreon group, came to the Nauticon conference and lots of first time meetings and everything. And it was incredible. I am bragging when I say this. The SGU patrons are a wonderful group of people.
Mm-hmm. It's a really good community.
It is. Yeah. We just got, I feel so lucky that we have so many good people in our community, you know, from all around the world. It's just a really, really cool group of people. And you could become a part of that group. Go to patreon.com/skepticsguide if you want to show us some support. You could also join our mailing list every week on Monday or Tuesday. We send out a weekly email that tells you everything that we've done in the SGU universe the week before, right? So it's last week's show, any YouTube videos, any TikTok videos, any blogs, all the content that we've created. We outline it all there for you. So it's the previous week worth of content. And all you got to do is go to theskepticsguide.org and sign up for this weekly newsletter. It's a lot of fun. We've been doing it now for what, like 6 weeks now, Steve?
Yeah, something like that.
Yeah, it's going good. And you could also, one last thing, if you enjoy the show, you can give our show a rating on any podcast player app out there. You could look and see if you can give us a rating on how you feel or a comment. That would be wonderful. It'll help other people find the show. Thanks, guys.
Thank you, Jay. One quick email. We had a few people follow up on my news item last week about the 50-year battery. You guys remember the beta radioactive decay to generate electricity. And, you know, there's Chinese companies saying, yeah, we can make a battery using, you know, beta decay of nickel 63 into copper, and it'll last for 50 years, which is their way of saying it has a half-life of 101 years, which is not, you know, unreasonable. But, yeah, we basically said the power, the numbers don't add up, right? It wouldn't create a lot of power. And, you know, don't expect this to be powering your phone anytime ever.
Hey, wasn't that my news item?
Was that yours? Oh, that was your news item. Yeah.
You blogged
I blogged about it, and then you talked about it on the show.
Yes,
yeah, you're right,
yes.
Bob. Yeah. So it was our news item. But, Bob, this is one thing you didn't talk about, and that is how much do the isotopes cost? And a few people.
Yeah, I mean, I just said quite expensive, but yeah, based on the email
with
the details, they're even more expensive than I thought.
More expensive. Yeah, I had read that too, but I thought, well, but if we just like deliberately mass produce them, could that bring the cost down? So right now,
you know, the waste products from the pre-existing. Yeah.
Apparently, though, even that's not going to work. So for example, if you're using nickel 63, that isotope for your beta decay source, apparently that would cost about $20,000 a gram. $20,000. So the battery for your phone, right, is going to cost $100,000. I don't know, incredible amount of money, like tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of dollars.
The last 50 years.
And one listener in particular, yeah, this was a Dr. Garrett Bruhaug gave us the most detailed information. And because this is apparently his area of expertise. So, yeah, you know, it's just crazy expensive. It would not absolutely not work. And the thing is, so according to him, and I did, you know, back this up with my own research, is that there's two reasons why this, like, you just can't use material from existing nuclear power plants to do this. One is that some of the isotopes you can't make in a commercial nuclear power plant. You would need a special one. Which, of course, that would be pointless. Again, it would be
major
so expensive. But here's the other thing, which I didn't know about, which he informed me of. The irradiation part aside, like just getting purifying the isotope you need to irradiate in the nuclear power plant is massively expensive. And like even if you used graphite, which is some nuclear power plants use graphite, like the rods as the way of controlling the reaction, and that creates a lot of carbon 14, which can be used as a beta source. But the problem is it's a little bit of carbon 14 mixed in with other isotopes. So you'd have to enrich it. And the enriching process is massively expensive. So basically there is no pathway to not ridiculously expensive beta sources, right? So like this is never going to be a consumer product.
With fission,
yeah. Yeah, he did say maybe if, like, in the future, if we get fusion reactors. But I think even then, it's the enriching that's going to be a limiting factor. So we would need to have some kind of breakthrough that will allow us to cheaply enrich these isotopes and then also cheaply irradiate them, right? It's like those two steps are both involved. Or you take irradiated stuff and you enrich the isotope that's going to be the beta. Either way, you need to both irradiate it and enrich it. And both of those things, either by itself, but certainly both together, makes this stuff in the tens of thousands of dollars per gram range, which means no, it's not going to be, not going to be a battery source, not going to be running your iPhone. Okay.
Yeah.
You know what that means.
Disappointing.
That means yes. It's time to go on with science or fiction.
It's time for science or fiction.
Each week I come up with three science news items or facts, two real, one fake. And I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one is the fake. And we have a very cool theme this week. The theme is the Ice Age.
Which one?
Evan, that pun was just for you. So when you say the Ice Age, that traditionally refers to the most recent Ice Age, which we are still in. There have been five Ice Ages on the Earth, but the Ice Age is the current one.
And we're in an Ice Age right now?
You say so.
Yes, we are in an interglacial period of an Ice Age. That's right. Okay, you guys ready?
Yep.
Mm. Here we go. Item number one. During the last glacial maximum, greater than 50% of the Earth's surface was covered in ice. Item number two, most of Canada has no native earthworms because they were wiped out during the last glacial period. And item number three, at the end of the last glacial period, about 10,000 years ago, the Earth's tilt, obliquity is the technical term, was 24.5 degrees. And since has decreased to its current 23.4 degrees. Kara, go first.
No.
Yes.
No. The end of the last glacial period. So all three of these reference the last glacial period. Is that right? They're all three referencing the same time frame. Okay, I just want to make that
much,
clear.
Yeah.
Okay. So basically you're asking, did the Earth's tilt decrease? By what would that be? 0.9 degrees? No, 1.1 degrees. Did Canada lose its earthworms or was the earth covered? Okay. Can you clarify something for me?
Mm-hmm.
You said greater than 50% of the Earth's surface.
Mm-hmm.
Do you mean land?
Nope. I mean the Earth's surface, just as stated.
I think that's the fiction. That seems like a lot. I could be wrong, but that seems like a lot.
Okay. Jay?
Yeah, the earthworm one seems really strange to me. And this was because of a glacial period. You know, but how, I don't know, because I don't know how deep they go and I don't know how far down the cold penetrates. I mean, I suppose that can happen. The third one here, at the end of the last glacial period, you know, 10,000 years ago, the Earth's tilt was 24.5 degrees, and since then has decreased. That sounds familiar to me. I don't know. I mean, I definitely agree with the Kara not liking the first one about 50% or greater than 50% of the Earth's surface was covered in ice. I don't think that when there has been past ice ages, or at least the last one, I don't think it covered half the planet. I don't think so. I think it was just, you know, because you know all the rocks, the huge boulders and rocks that can be found, like, for example, in New England, in the area where I grew up, that they have marks on them from being pushed from the Arctic ice, right?
That's right.
Like Long Island came from debris that got pushed by glaciers, if I'm remembering my history correctly. But I think that's about as far as it went. I don't think it went down to, like, the equator or something. Yeah, I
down to the equator would be 100%, Jay.
Right, because you're going from...
It's going from both ways, yeah.
Right.
Understood. Yeah, I don't think it's 50%. I think it's much less than that.
Okay, Evan?
I think I'm on board with this particular one. I am familiar with the Earth tilt changing over years. I can't remember the exact change, but this seems reasonable that 24.5, I think, is close to where it... maximally tilts, and it goes back down to like 22 or something. So it fluctuates back and forth. And that has a name to it. I think somebody who discovered it, I can't remember what it's called. But the earthworm one I've never heard of before. And certainly to say it was wiped out during the last glacial period, that's new news to me. But it's the 50% of the Earth's surface. I mean, yes, Jay, I also recall that the glaciers pushed down debris and everything and formed Long Island. I was taught the same thing, and on the retreat, all the boulders and things were revealed in the wake of its sort of destruction, if you can call it. But the 50%, that'd be the oceans? No, I don't think it got over the oceans like that. No way. So I think 50% of the Earth's surface is fiction.
Okay, and Bob?
I think I'm prepared to be surprised by the 50% Earth. Yeah, I think that one's going to be science. The earthworms, yeah, I could see glaciers wreaking havoc. And since you guys are talking about your, you know, interesting facts with glaciers, my favorite is the fact that the ice from the glaciers over, like, say, North America was so heavy.
How heavy was
that,
it?
How it was so heavy.
It was so heavy.
It compressed the land, and the land is still springing up as we speak. It's still popping back up after that compression.
Boing.
So for some reason, I know you guys are – some of you are confident about the tilt. I don't remember seeing the tilt changing that much in just the past 10,000 years. I had something that's rubbing me the wrong way. I'm just totally going on my gut with that one because it seems reasonable that it could mess up the tilt that way with all that ice. But I'm going to stick with the number one with the 50% and say that that's science. But I'll say that the obliquity, I'm going to say that one's fiction.
Okay, so you guys all agree on number two. So we'll start there. Most of Canada has no native earthworms because they were wiped out during the last glacial period. You guys all think that one is science, and that one is science. That one is science. Yeah, the glaciers killed
just
all the earthworms.
Oh, my goodness.
But why wouldn't they just put them back, you know, bring them in from other places? Because the earthworms are really important, aren't they?
Well, as I said, there are no native earthworms. Europeans imported earthworms. This was like not just Canada, but also Northern United States. And
really?
And you know, I had to say most because there were some areas that didn't get a lot of glacier and the earthworms survived. But basically most of Canada has no native earthworms and earthworms can only spread so fast, you know, and so they haven't had enough time. They are slow. Yeah, they haven't had enough time to spread back into that area. And so basically the ecosystem evolved without earthworms. And then Europeans came in and imported earthworms for their farming and gardens and whatnot. And it's actually wreaking havoc with the local ecosystem because they're evolved without earthworms.
Damn, man.
Yeah. So the species that are there are not native. They're all introduced.
Pesky humans.
Yeah. Interesting. Okay. Which one should we go to next? So
say
I guess
it,
the question is, how much of the Earth do you think was covered by the glacier during the last glacial maximum?
Probably 10%.
25%.
What do you think, Kara?
50.
I split the difference between the two of them. I'll say 17.5%.
And then the other on the flip side is so, what is the relationship with the tilt of the Earth's axis and?
Yeah,
the glacial period.
Curious about that.
So would a greater tilt, which means more extreme seasons, be associated with the glacial period or the interglacial period? You know what I mean? With that, what do you think about that? That's interesting. The axis does change over historical time.
So isn't that why we have glacial periods?
That's the question. Is that why we have glacial periods? And if so, what's the relationship? Mm-hmm. Right? Is there more tilt? Or less tilt?
I'd say less.
I'd say more.
I'd say...
I have no idea.
More extreme weather is also hotter summers.
That's right. So...
Right.
Number three, at the end of the last glacial period, about 10,000 years ago, the Earth's tilt obliquity was 24.5 degrees, and since then has decreased to its current 23.4 degrees. Bob, you think this one is fiction. The rest of you think this one is science. And this one is science.
Oh.
So, Bob, you're right.
Whoa.
But that's why the glacial period started to melt when we hit the maximal tilt, because the summer heat.
Yes.
The summers are more extreme, even though the fact that the winters are more extreme didn't really have much of an impact. But the fact that the summers are hot enough to start to melt the glaciers. And so, of course, it's taken a long time for that to happen, right? But, so and now we're getting... The tilt is getting smaller and smaller, and the minimum is 22.1 degrees, right? So it goes between 24.5 and 22.1. We're kind of in the middle right now at 23.4.
And that's consistent? I mean, that's just like, we think that's consistent?
Yeah, that's a...
Back forth.
It's a 41,000-year cycle. It's a wobble, you know, it's a 41,000-year cycle. And you know what drives that cycle?
Dynamo?
It's not the sun. Volcanoes. It's not anything intrinsic to the Earth, and it's not the sun.
Oh.
Our position in the galaxy?
Nope. Good guess. That's a really good guess. Happens to be wrong. The current theory is that it's Jupiter and Saturn. It's the gravitational tugging of Jupiter and Saturn.
Really?
Yep. Wow.
Wow. Can account for a two and a half degree change in the...
There are two other cycles. These are collectively called the Milankovitch cycle. That's what you're thinking of.
That's the name.
So there's the eccentricity of the sun, and some people thought, oh, maybe when we're farther from the sun, that correlates with it, but no, it doesn't. It's really the eccentricity also changes again because of the big planets, and that changes from, it's almost circular to just slightly eccentric, but that is too little to really have any significant effect.
Yeah, it's not that big
on climate. And then the third one is precession, and for a while we thought the precession was causing the glacial periods. But that's a 26,000-year cycle, and it doesn't correlate. It doesn't line up with the glacial periods. But
that's the wobbling like a top.
Yeah, that's the one where a spinning top will rotate around, you know, its axis. But it's the wobble of the obliquity that correlates best with the with the glacial periods. Interesting. All of this means that during the last glacial maximum, greater than 50% of the Earth's surface was covered in ice. That one is the fiction, because the real answer is, you guys were all wrong, it's a third, 33%. So Yeah, it's still more than you think, but I had to exaggerate it enough, you know, but I guess I overshot a bit. But it's a lot, though. You think about a third of the Earth's surface, and not the land surface. The Earth's surface was covered in ice during the last glacial maximum, which was about 20,000 years ago.
We have had 100% of the snow called Earth.
What? Yes. There's been at least two times. Although, Bob, I don't know if you've heard, but some scientists call it slushball Earth because they think it was maybe not totally frozen over. But it was either snowball Earth or slushball Earth. One of those cycles lasted 300 million years. Another one lasted 200 million years. Yeah. Before we eventually came out of them.
Wonder what life was like under all that.
Takes
snow.
A long time to get. Oh my gosh. Yeah.
Well, this is like, the first one was 2.4 to 2.1 billion years ago. So there was life on Earth, but there was, you know,
it's all
probably pre-multicellular life. Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. So good job, guys.
Thank you, Steve.
Yeah.
Evan, give us a quote. I'm still good at fooling Bob, apparently.
Yeah. All right. Goddamn expert at it.
This quote was suggested by a listener, Christos from Ottawa. Thanks for suggesting this one, Christos. We swallow greedily any lie that flatters us, but we sip only little by little at a truth we find bitter. And that was by the French philosopher Denis Diderot from the Enlightenment period in the 1700s.
Yeah, very enlightening.
Prominent figure during the Age of Enlightenment. Also studied philosophy at a Jesuit college. Now, Steve and Bob, what, you guys went to a Jesuit high school?
We did.
Right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It was an interesting experience, you know, because it was the Jesuit, it's Catholic, but it's at the non-magical end of the spectrum, you know, of Catholic beliefs. You know what I mean? Like, there are the subset of Catholics who believe, like, all of the magic, right? Like, in possession and demons and that kind of stuff. The Jesuits are the philosophers. They're the scholars and philosophers within the Catholic tradition. And so I took 4 years of theology in high school.
Yeah.
But it was very much like you could almost like not even believe in God and still study what we were studying. You know what I mean?
Like
it was
critical analysis.
It was kind of incidental. Like the fact that God exists was kind of incidental to what we were studying. It was more like the history of the Jewish people, like the Bible as literature, as work, like what, you know what I mean?
Read the whole damn thing.
Yeah. And I thought it was a good experience, especially as a skeptic. Like having a really good working knowledge of the Bible comes in handy a lot, you know, for a lot of the stuff that we deal with. Like, Carrie, your background is the same thing, right?
Yeah, we had to go to I stayed in Mormonism until I was 15 is when I left, but because I was born into it, obviously we did like your standard Bible and Book of Mormon study in like on Sundays, but we also had Wednesday night youth group, and then some people know this, some people don't. Mormon children, once they get to high school, they go to seminary before school every day.
Mm-hmm.
So I had like at 6 a.m., I had an hour of like Bible and Book of Mormon study every day before school. And like, obviously I hated it. It was like horrible. But looking back, I'm really glad. I mean, I was like half asleep most of the time, but I am really glad that like there was so much of that scholarship. Now, don't get me wrong. Ours, my study was not kind of like a secular approach to those texts. It was deeply biased and I had to like undo all of that. But it was really cool to have been able to have read all of those books and annotate them and, you know, yeah.
Yeah, I think it gives you more insight, you know, into belief systems, whether religious or otherwise, you know. And I do like I have colleagues within the skeptical community who are atheists and critical thinkers and skeptics, and they were always atheists, right? They were brought up in an atheist household. And I do think they have a harder time wrapping their head around the mind of a believer. You know, I mean, having spent part of their life inside of that, you know?
Yeah.
It's like, for me, it's easy to understand how people rationalize their beliefs and how they square that circle and resolve their cognitive dissonance and all that stuff. Cause I was there, you know, when I was younger.
Oh yeah. 100%. And like, I tried to believe it.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
I bought into it when I was really young. Maybe not. I don't know. It's hard to say. But I actually, when I was in Scotland these past couple of weeks, I actually rewatched Under the Banner of Heaven. Mm-hmm. And if you guys still haven't seen that, I highly recommend
it. Yeah,
we saw
it.
It is a brilliant series. Okay, good. But I think it can help some people, because especially like with the Mormons, a lot of people are like, how do they believe that? I think that Andrew Garfield, well, the writer, you know, just the entire production does help you sort of put your head in the mind of somebody who's struggling with their faith and see it from that perspective.
So, my recollection, and I think the hardest thing for me, like what Catholics are really good at is guilt and shame.
Oh, yeah.
And we were raised to think that faith was a virtue. And that was so deeply embedded in us. That was the last thing to go. Like just to realize I could be a good person without faith. That was the last thing that I got rid of,
right.
You know, because that was so deeply built in to our childhood.
Gosh.
And it's not, and we really? Weren't even that religious. You know what I mean? We didn't go to church every Sunday, but it was just sort of baked into our worldview to such a degree. I didn't even realize how much we internalized that until we're like, gee, you're right. There, it's not a virtue. I could be a good person without having faith, you know? Mm-hmm. And that didn't happen until college for me, you know, where I got rid of the last vestiges of that programming.
Oof.
You know?
Yeah, that's rough.
Yep. We've all emerged to some degree at some point. Yeah. We were all there.
Yeah.
That was actually kind of the topic of, I remember an organization, I think it was the Freedom From Religion organization gave me an award once, and that was sort of the topic of my talk, was this idea of like morality among secular individuals and how it's sort of our duty as citizens to be, you know, moral individuals and to set good examples, because the perception among so many religious people is that somebody who's atheist is fundamentally lacking those
by
virtues.
Definition.
And the opposite is the truth.
Oh, 100%. Because the reason we're like that is not because somebody told us to be like that. You know, we got there on our own. I want to be good to my fellow human.
I love when they imply that they would, without God in the Bible, they would be raping and pillaging. Really?
Right.
Yeah, really.
I mean, I've had people say that to me, like religious people. Yeah. And I look at it. So you're telling me if it weren't for the threat of going to hell, your instinct would be to go out raping and pillaging and murdering?
Right.
Like, that's what you would be doing?
Remarkable.
If you didn't have a supernatural being telling you not to? But again, it's just built into their worldview. They don't even really think about it rationally.
Right.
No, I don't think so.
It's such a convenient
because you hear the same argument with the anti-LGBTQ kind of stuff. Like when you talk to somebody who's deeply religious and also very anti-gay, they always use the same argument about like protecting the family structure, whatever it is. But it's always like, well, we can't let them marry because then what, you'd just be gay tomorrow? Like, is that your reasoning?
That's insane.
But yeah, you'd hear those arguments all the time.
Mm-hmm. Mm. Right. All right. Well, thank you all for joining me this week.
Sure, man.
Thanks, Steve.
Thanks, Steve.
And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions. dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information, visit us at theskepticsguide.org. Send your questions to info@theskepticsguide.org. And if you would like to support the show and all the work that we do, go to patreon.com/skepticsguide and consider becoming a patron and becoming part of the SGU community. Our listeners and supporters are what make SGU possible.